Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Laura Snowden. I'm the Dean of Students. And a very big welcome to our guests and a very big congratulations to our graduates. I'm very proud of you, as a lot of us are. Although I wish you all the best, and I'm glad you're graduating and moving on, I have to confess I'm going to miss you. We've been together for a while, and I value the friendships I've made. So please stay in touch. I'll be here, so you know, please let me know what you'll be doing and where you'll be. I hope to see some of you at the career fair, hiring some of our students, which is always a great thing to see. It's always fun to see you in a few years from now. And come back as alumni and be sure to check in. So this is the eighth year we've had a class day speaker. In the fall, the graduates nominate and vote on who they would like to have send them off. And this year they picked Chris Anderson. I'm very grateful he accepted, and believe me, he's a very busy man, and it's an honor to have him here today. Dan Sullivan, a Master in Architecture graduate, is going to introduce Chris. Thank you.
Good evening, and welcome again. Before I introduce Chris for the evening, I just want to give you a little background about why we chose him. Chris is a curator of TED, and for those of you that don't know, TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And it's a conference series of 20-minute talks on those themes by people who are at the cutting edge of their fields. These speakers have included Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Malcolm Gladwell, Elizabeth Gilbert, and representatives from our own disciplines, including Frank Gehry, Tom Main, Cameron Sinclair, Joshua Prince-Ramos. And these are just a small sampling of the nearly 900 people who have addressed TED Talks and whose talks are available online for free. So as we and our families know, we've essentially lived in this building for our tenure here. And while most of that time is highly structured, there are moments where watching TV or a movie are actually appropriate complements to our work. So it's at these times that you'll see TED Talks on the screens as you walk through the trays, and subsequently emails that go out circulating links to ones that are particularly relevant or inspiring. But in some way, all of these talks are relevant. In the synthetic disciplines of architecture, landscape architecture, urban planning, urban design, and design studies, we're always looking to synthesize issues of policy and of art and media and technology, education, and design. So for us, I think TED Talks offer us an opportunity to look outside of our own disciplines. And they remind us that we're part of this lineage of visionaries. So there's a lot to take from that that's inspiring. And of course, it's Chris's own vision that brings these talks to us. Spending his early life in Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, Chris went on to study at Oxford. After a long career in journalism, he turned a small publishing company into one of the largest media companies in the UK. Following the expansion of that company to the US, Chris was able to found the Sapling Foundation, which acquired TED and has really just catapulted the brand to the global renown that it has today. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure to introduce the man who has, in curating these talks, provided us with endless hours of creative inspiration, of comedic interlude, and of ideas worth sharing. So, Chris Anderson.
Dan, thank you. That was very generous. Thank you, Laura. Although I'm not sure if you know, I actually don't give many speeches. I'm usually the guy on the other side of the invitation, which is certainly a lot more comfortable. But I couldn't pass up the chance to spend some time with such a remarkable group of people. It's truly an honor to be here. And to begin with, a favor, I would very much like the people who are actually graduating tomorrow, to stand up if you would. I would like to see you properly. Can you stand up? That's fantastic. Congratulations, stay standing.
stay standing. Please stay standing. Please, if you would, if you would just hold your heads completely still for a moment, I'd appreciate it. I've got a very cool app here on my iPad. I'm actually not taking your pictures, but I am, if it's okay, just taking a complete brain download from each of you. Thank you very much. You can sit now. Now, alas, this app is still kind of in pre-alpha mode. It doesn't work that reliably yet. But if it did, I wonder what we would read out from it. I mean, today there would be all kinds of emotions associated with your time here and what's to come. Some nostalgia, some excitement, some hope, some regrets, a little bit of panic. There would also probably be somewhere buried in there some unexpected jealousies, embarrassing memories, a complete record of everything that happened late at night over at the Trays. Everything, of course, is 100% privacy protected. So long as you remember to check the box marked no public humiliation, did you? But along with all that, there would be something else in this data. We'd be able to see, if we looked the right way, an astonishing picture of the future. Better than any crystal ball or forecasting tool, we could see what our world will look like in a couple of decades' time. Now, I mean this quite literally and seriously, because by getting this far in this place, you, the Harvard Graduate School of Design 2011 class, have proved that you possess a certain incredible talent. It's a talent that's unique to our species. And I suspect that if you were to rank this talent among members of our species in general, you would all be in the top 1% of 1%. I'm not talking about intelligence, fine breeding, good looks, dress sense, or compelling social skills, although I have no doubt you have all those too. I'm talking about the talent that people call imagination, or invention, or innovation. It's the remarkable ability to, first of all, model some aspect of the world inside our heads, and then secondly, to play with that model. And suddenly, bingo, we find a way to rearrange it so that it is, in some sense, better. I mean, this is the amazing engine that underpins both technology, the T of TED, and design, the D. I really think it's this skill, more than anything, that has made possible human progress of the last 50,000 years. And it's pretty astonishing that we can do this. For almost the entire period of life on Earth, the appearance of design has been driven differently by random trial and error. Like a drunkard lumbering through a dark maze of passages, life has lurched its way forward. And for every evolutionary step forward, there have been thousands of dead ends. In a single lifetime, change was not detectable. It happened slowly, painfully, over millions of years. Somehow, in our species, some tens of thousands of years ago, the light came on. We found a way to model the future before lumbering into it, and that changed everything. Viewed from a different perspective, you could say that our brains became the ecosystems for a new kind of life, a life that replicated and transformed itself at a rate hitherto unknown in our corner of the universe. I'm talking, of course, about the thrilling life of the world of ideas. TED is dedicated to nurturing that life. And in a sense, you're about to spend the rest of your life devoted to that same mission. But whereas we at TED nurture ideas by putting up conference lectures free on the internet, you're not just going to be dreaming about them. You're actually going to make them real. You're going to turn them into reality, so that thousands or millions of other people will be impacted by them. And that's why I am so excited about this group brain scan that I'm holding right here in my hand. It's the future right here. And I actually think I can make out something here. It's a little bit fuzzy, but espoused in a mind over here, I can make out a gorgeous building full of natural light, bio-inspired curves, evoking wonder and delight in everyone who sees it, I think. At the back, you know, there's the signs of a former industrial wasteland converted into a glorious city park. I could see people gathering, milling, walking, playing, dreaming. Oh my goodness, from a mind on this side, here, it's a spectacular city of the future. It's one in which cars are replaced by intelligent next-generation transport systems, human-scale meeting places where people naturally mingle and connect, a city which breathes and adjusts and interacts with its citizens like a living system. So, you know, I am certain that the picture of the future which would emerge if you were to sum up all of these brain scans, it would be enticing, it would be powerful, it would be thrilling. And the most thrilling thing of all is that it's going to become real. A substantial part of the dreams that are in this room now, in the next couple of decades, will actually become real. Why? Because you will make it so. You're the graduating class of the GSD 2011. More than almost anyone in the world, you have the talent and the resources to shape the future. So, here's the rub. What will determine which of these dreams see reality and which languish unfunded, forgotten, ignored? I mean, usually a single person can't make an idea come true unless they have extremely rich parents. It's a little bit of nervous laughter there. I think we should. No, in almost every case, ideas need multiple backers. And so that means that for an idea to become real, it first must spread from brain to brain, generating excitement as it goes. Well, how does that happen? It certainly helps if the idea itself is powerful, by which I mean some combination of, you know, ingenious, beautiful, affordable. But there's something else. It needs to be communicated with passion, with power. One of the most tragic things in the world is a really powerful idea that's stuck inside the head of someone who can't explain it to anyone else. You know, at TED over the years, we've had a lot of architects come and share their visions with us. And a good number of them have been absolutely awful. I mean, how can that be? They have the most compelling subject matter imaginable, giant designs at a scale that impact thousands of people. Yet when it comes to articulating them, they sometimes descend into gibberish. The abstract, over-intellectual language of architectural criticism that makes an audience's eyes glaze over and their brains go numb. You know, this strikes me as a complete tragedy. Whatever else you do in your coming years, I beg you, I truly beg you to find a way to communicate the amazingness of what you're doing in the language in which the rest of the world can get and respond to, because they really want to. They really do. Now, the good news is that you're entering the profession at a wonderful moment. I mean, look, I'm speaking as an outsider, but from my perch, it seems to me that there are three giant trends that are combining to transform both the role of architecture and the language and the way in which it can be talked about. So first of all, in recent years, a mode of thought that arguably has dominated intellectual life for much of the past century is gradually, thankfully, being laid to rest. I'm referring to the toxic belief that human nature and aesthetic values are infinitely malleable. They're determined purely by cultural norms. Now, for a while, that mode of thought gave a generation of architects a sense of exhilarating freedom, the right to abandon all traditional architectural rules, impose their own vision on society. But like similar experiments in music, art, drama, and literature, they didn't always win the world's love. Today, I think there's a growing consensus that we should think of humans differently, that far from living in separate cultural bubbles, we actually share millions of years of evolutionary history, that there are far more ways in which we're the same than that we are different. The anthropologist Donald Brown has documented more than 200 human universals present in every culture on Earth. They range from things like body adornment, dancing, feasting, to common facial expressions, and yes, shared aesthetic values. And on this latter question of aesthetics, it's been the subject of countless experiments around the world in the past couple of decades. And they've mostly revealed an amazing degree of resonance among vastly different people on what they find beautiful. Now, this shift surely is going to change the language in which architecture is discussed. I mean, in a world of pure cultural relativism, I mean, there are no absolutes to appeal to. To succeed, you had to learn the opaque language of a tight-knit clique of critics and opinion formers. It didn't matter if the rest of the world was left scratching its head. Today, slowly, gingerly, I think, it's become possible once again to use the language the rest of us can understand. And I think it's even okay to use that B word again, beauty. I mean, not as a proxy for arrogant, artistic self-expression, but as a quest to tap into something that can resonate deeply in millions of souls around the world. And I'm happy to report that in the last couple of years at TED, we've been wowed by a new generation of architects, people like Joshua Prince-Ramos, Bjarke Ingels, Liz Diller, Thomas Heatherwick, and others, as they've shared with us, in plain English, their passion, their dreams, and yes, the beauty of what they've created. You know, when Thomas Heatherwick unveiled his vision of this new residential complex in Kuala Lumpur, sort of curved out from a narrow base like a bed of tulips, I just had one thought looking at it. I wish I was going to be born in the future. Now, I suppose an architect might have dreamt of such a development 30 years ago, but it could never have been built. And that brings us to the second trend. Technology is changing the rules of what's possible. I mean, the astounding power of computer-aided design and new construction techniques are giving you the ability to actually build what before could only have been like a whimsical doodle on a sketch pad. Suddenly, the fractals and curves of Mother Nature are a legitimate part of the architectural lexicon. And around the world, as people watch these buildings arise, instead of muttering under their breath, monstrosity, their jaws are dropping and their eyes are moistening. And finally, perhaps most important of all, we're at a moment in history where the world is paying attention to you like never before. You see, as leading designers of scale, you, more than anyone else in the world, hold in your hands the answers to the most important question that we all face. And the question is this: can the coming world of 10 billion people survive and flourish without consuming itself? The answers to that question, if they are to be found, and count me among those who says they will be found, they will come from design. Better ways to pattern our lives. Because there's nothing written into our nature that says that the only path to a wonderful, rich, meaningful life is to own two cars and a McMansion in the suburbs. But it's becoming urgent for the world to start to see a compelling alternative vision. Probably, probably, that is going to come, that is going to come by reimagining what a city can be and making it so wonderful that few people would want to live anywhere else. I mean, if there were to be 10 billion of us, we will have, for the most part, to live close to each other, if only to give the rest of nature a chance. Indeed, more than half the world already lives in cities, and the best of those cities offer so much to the world, richer culture, a greater sense of community, a far lower carbon footprint per person, and perhaps most importantly of all, greater collision of ideas, which drives innovation. Now, the future cities that you will help create need not feel claustrophobic or soulless. I mean, I can see that right here. By incorporating light, plants, trees, water, beautiful organic forms into the city's structures and landscapes. By imagining new ways that people can connect with each other, work with each other, you will allow the coming crowd to live more richly, more meaningfully than has ever been possible in history. And you can do that without sacrificing your grandchildren. Finally, I guess it's traditional this time to offer some, you know, personal advice to you as you embark on your careers. Everything from one word, plastics, to follow your dream, pursue your passion. You know, that mantra of romantically pursuing passion is hammered into us in countless movies, novels, pulp TV. I'm actually not convinced it's the best advice. I mean, apart from the fact that many people actually aren't sure what their passion is and they're kind of panicked about that, there are lots of things in life, lots of wonderful things in life, that you absolutely should not pursue directly. I mean, take love, for example. You know, we all want love, but there's a word for people who pursue it too directly. Stalkers. And take happiness. You know, happiness is great, we want it. If you make that your single-minded goal, you won't become happy, you'll become a hedonist, an addict, a narcissist. A musician who really wants the absolute in musical, artistic creativity, doesn't get there by trying to be creative. She gets there by pursuing discipline, by listening, learning, and by practicing for hundreds or thousands of hours until the creativity just flows. You know, the architect Moshe Safdie ended his TED talk a few years ago with this poem. He who seeks order shall find gratification. He who seeks gratification shall be disappointed. He who considers himself the servant of his fellow beings shall find the joy of self-expression. He who seeks self-expression shall fall into the pit of arrogance. Arrogance is incompatible with nature. Through nature, the nature of the universe, and the nature of man, we shall seek truth. If we seek truth, we shall find beauty. So I guess my advice would be, don't pursue your passion directly, at least not yet. Instead, pursue the things that will empower you. Pursue knowledge. You know, be relentlessly curious, forever. You're leaving Harvard this week. You can't stop learning, though. You can't. Pursue discipline. It's an old-fashioned word, but it's never been more important. Today's world is full of an impossible number of distractions. The people who changed the world will be the people who managed to find a way of ignoring most of them. And above all, pursue generosity, not just because it will add meaning to your life, and it will, but because your future is going to be built on great ideas. And in the future you are entering, great ideas have to be given away. They do. The world's more interconnected than ever, and the rules about what you can give and what you can hold on to have changed forever. If you hold on to your best ideas, yes, you might gain some short-term commercial benefit. But if you let them roam free, they can spread like wildfire, earning you a global reputation. They can be reshaped and improved by others. They can achieve impact and influence in the world far greater than you could do if you held them close. And if there's one thing we've discovered at TED over the last few years, it's that radical openness pays. When we decided to give away our talks free of charge on the internet 5 years ago, far from killing demand for the conference, it actually dialed up that demand spectacularly. And in a short period of time, it moved TED from being something that touched the lives of 800 people once a year to something that touched the lives of 500,000 people every day. When we gave away our brand, TED, in the form TEDx, far from diluting TED, it democratized it, and it increased its footprint 1,000-fold. So knowledge, discipline, generosity. If you pursue those with all the determination you possess, one day, before too long, without you even knowing it, the chance to realize your most spectacular dreams will come, gently tap you on the shoulder and whisper, "Let's go." And you'll be ready. And that is how you're going to help shape a better future for all of us. No pressure or anything, but we're counting on you. Thank you. There's time for questions. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm told there's some time for questions. About this, or about TED, or about life, the universe, and everything. What was I saying about being curious?
Great chapters for growing up and founding the most subtle charger of the world, the Afghanistan, Pakistan border, and then having lived in England as a journalist, what prompted you to get into the audiovisual journalism and into the TED Talk arena?
So did people hear the question? Because the mic's not working now. Question was, after a background in Asia and England, what prompted me to get into the audiovisual area of journalism? I mean, I didn't originally. I was a print journalist for a few years, and then I launched a magazine company. And we were pursuing passion, actually. It's funny, that. But other people's passion, not mine. Other passion is a proxy for, you know, great potential. And round about 1995, this thing called the internet came along, and most of the magazines that we were producing and the content that they were on, a lot of the passion that was in there evaporated onto the web, because the heart of those communities found that information better online. So I got dragged into becoming a kind of a web guy a little bit, and then 10 years later, the web got bandwidth that was fat enough to carry video. I think online video is going to turn out to be a huge catalytic transformer of media, because it allows every single skill that there is on earth, whether it's playing the harpsichord or sharing an idea, it allows it to be captured and shared globally with potentially millions of people, and become that sort of melting pot where you can. My entry initially was just purely as an experiment. We gave away 6 talks from TED. On video, because the TV companies had turned us down, just to see what would happen. And to our astonishment, they actually worked. We didn't think that watching a talk in 4 square inches of real estate on a screen could work, that it would engage people's emotions. And what persuaded us to flip TED on its head was the fact that we were getting emails from people saying, "I am weeping looking at this talk. You have changed my daughter's life." And we thought, whoa. TED can't be a conference anymore. TED has to be ideas were spreading. And we ended up deciding to give away all the content. Yeah. See if that, we can get that mic to work as well.
Thank you. I've often wondered if Ted and Davos will ever marry in any way.
I mean, Davos is awesome. It's been a critical meeting place for the world's mighty for many years. Ted, we sometimes say it, Ted, you know, politicians come and go, ideas are forever. And I think we fundamentally have different agendas. Davos is about the here and now. It's bringing together the people who are making policy decisions here and now, and that's an important role. We like to cover mainly the ideas that have a longer burn to them than the issue du jour. Those issues are covered in the media endlessly, you know, lots of heads being butted together left and right. We're looking for the inventions that will shape the next century, you know, the design ideas that create the landscape through which we all will live. And, you know, I don't know, I look back and look at the things that have made an impact on my life. And a few of them are the things that politicians or bankers have done. And, but a lot of them are actually things that, you know, someone made, a company's made. There's an important role for both, but we like the world of ideas, and we've got lots of friends in Davos and huge respect for them, but we have a different role to play.
In a world where the internet democratizes information and ideas, it also allows for a 24-hour media cycle where pundits and people can be spouting off and spreading ideas all the time, and there's a constantly changing news story. What do you think, or how do you think the media environment will change or shape in the future to sort of accommodate or grow beyond that, or lessen some of the negative effects of that?
I mean, I don't know is the answer to that. I think it's all to be paid for. The media environment is such an ecosystem. It's chaotic. It's unpredictable. As I said earlier, you know, that there are a lot of distractions out there. You can, even just the good stuff, you can easily spend, you know, waste a day or spend a day, let's not say waste, but just following information or gossip or whatever. We don't have an off switch for information any more than we have an off switch for fat and sugar. It's a problem. We need to think about this, and it's one of the areas where discipline comes in. I think every individual has to make their choice. It's very easy to do a number of things. It's easy to spend too much time distracted. It's easy to get lost in a little bubble of your own where you're only talking in an echo chamber to the people who already agree with you. One role that traditional media played was that they spread in front of you, whether you wanted it or not, a wider array of provocation of stories. And that's in danger of going away as information gets more personalized. So there's lots of things to be concerned about. And I think the only thing you can say is that everyone can make their own media habits. We were absolutely astonished and thrilled to discover that there is at least a group of people who want to sit down and watch lectures for 18 minutes on the internet. That was a surprise. We thought it was all about kitten videos. And and so we're happy about that, and we shall see, but I really feel it's all to be played for. Whoever can get a mic.
Chris, that was most inspiring. Many of the great ideas that you properly cited are in the heads of these graduates. Will face political battles. It won't be a question of whether the idea is good or not. It's a question of whether there's a political will to execute that idea. So say something about how you believe the power of ideas can compete with political power.
So that's the $60,000 question. And in a way, it's what certainly what we see our mission about is to try to improve the conversation that the world is having. One of the things we've learned about ourselves in the last few decades is just how quirky we are as a species, that we very easily get locked into things that aren't necessarily that important for our long-term future. And politicians have this problem that they have to get elected, and so that they go along with that. And so much of the toxicity in politics is not around the lack of ideas. It's that the best ideas get killed by someone saying, that'll never fly, before they've even considered it. So somehow we have to gradually spread a better conversation, a smarter, more insightful way of looking at the world that will one day, perhaps sooner than we think, allow a politician of vision to say, you know what? That's what you might naturally think, but let's stop and think about this for a minute. There's actually a different way to look at this. Don't we want to dream about a better long-term future? Don't we want to think of more than just next year's GDP or this statistic or whatever? And one day, I think in the not-too-distant future, there will be a critical mass of people who will say yes, because, well, I'm an optimist. In the very long term, truth wins. Persuasion wins. Truth wins because there is always one more argument you can put on the side of truth to non-truth, because it's true. And long term, I believe truth will win, but that is the whole thing. It's about building a constituency, and maybe someone won't be able to build a constituency in the town or the country where they want to, but they can find somewhere else on the planet that will get excited about their vision, and they can prove it. And we, because we're more connected than ever, because these things are more visible than ever, when something is working somewhere in the world, it's just much more easier to say, look, this works, try it. But we'll see. I don't know. I think you have to take the optimistic stance, otherwise we all give up. Someone wants a microphone here, isn't it? This one back there. Has anyone got a mic back there? You go ahead.
Thank you. Given the phenomenon of TED, it sounds like, and the interest of design, it sounds like that you've listened as you kind of moved along. Could you make some comments from a design perspective about how the phenomenon has emerged of TED?
How the TED design, yeah. So the question is from a design perspective, did the TED phenomenon emerge? I would say that emerge is actually the right word to choose there, because people sometimes say, you know, how did you do this? As if there was a sort of a five-year plan. I don't believe in roadmaps. I think in the complicated world that we're in, you can't find your way to the future with a roadmap, because the future is too complicated and chaotic, and it will surprise you, and the roadmap will be worthless within a year. What you can do is to hold very tightly onto a compass, and that compass can espouse certain really important values, and you can be guided by them. And the values we've held on to, certainly most recently, is this one of radical openness. It's, you know, because we're in the world of ideas, and ideas want to spread, so let them. Let it out there. In many ways, the whole journey of TED over the last 10 years has been the awareness that there was something very special that happened, you know, in a conference when people came together and were exposed to ideas from all different areas of knowledge. So how can you let that out? So the design idea has just been find the right ways to let it out. And we tried with TV. We found that putting them out free on the web brought in this whole vast group of people. The next open piece was, how do we get into other languages? And instead of, it was too hard a task to translate the traditional way, so we let volunteer translators do it. And I think we have more than 5,000 translators now, and translations of most of the talks into 70 or 80 languages. And so that's been one of the core guiding principles, is let openness rule and see what people will do with this stuff, because they will always surprise you. And so with this TEDx movement that's happening right now, where there's about 3 or 4 TEDx events being held somewhere in the world every day, we're not doing them at all. We just set out a simple set of rules. We've offered people our brand. we've said people can't make money out of it or use it for politics or commercial or you know, religious or you know, quackery or whatever. But otherwise they do it, and it's their financial risk, it's their personal risk. And people haven't just astonished us with the time and love and the energy that they've put into it. They've astonished us with some of the things that they've tried that's better than what we could ever have thought of. And that is totally thrilling. So I definitely believe in that sense of some things. Don't build them, let them grow.
I was wondering how TED judge that an idea is worth spreading. What is the selection process?
The selection process for speakers to come?
Yes.
Well, again, it's incorporates crowd wisdom. We get hundreds, actually thousands of suggestions in from members of the community, both from the conference itself and from all over the web. And so there's a fantastic start pool. And then from within that, we try and incorporate a group that is something of a match to a very broad theme that we have each year. We've had themes like, you know, the pursuit of happiness or, you know, the big questions. I mean, it's the themes that can cover multiple things. And that guides it. Beyond that, there's no formula, I would say. But anyone can, you know, apply to be a TED speaker. Anyone can recommend someone else to be one. These days, we're looking to see that not just that someone has a great idea, but that they can communicate it. You know, and those are two different things, unfortunately. We'll work with people, and if they think that they're kind of, you know, they're almost there, but it could be made, you know, better. So it's a great idea that fits the theme. Selected from a huge number of choice from the crowd, and then working with them to try and help them make the talk as wonderful as it can be.
In this world that is emerging, what happens to face-to-face community?
I mean, it's more important than ever, I think. I think a lot of people feel a sense of alienation from, you know, various things, probably partly spending too much time online, partly, you know, who knows what else. And so live experiences where people come together are an incredibly important part of what people will do. And you can tell that by the fact that they're willing to pay a lot of money for it. And if you look in the music business, you know, CDs are now free, or, you know, pirated, whatever, you know, they're certainly no more expensive than they were 30 years ago, even in actual dollar terms. The live experience is 7x what it was, you know, that time ago. And so people want to meet. That there are surprisingly compelling ways of meeting over the web. You know, anyone who's made a Skype call knows that. I mean, it's shocking, actually, that you can sit down with someone on the other side of the world and look them in the eye and actually have quite a connecting experience. So I don't think it's all about shaking hands and so forth. I actually think getting close up face to face and looking someone in the eye gets you 75% of the way there almost in terms of, you know, personal connection, which may be important for the future of the world in terms of carbon footprint and so forth. But no, there's no question that we the more people go online, the more important those moments are when we gather. And I think it feels like there's lots of wonderful experiments being tried. TEDx is just one of many types of things that are going on that are quite exciting. One more, and then that's it. Last question.
Since I'm the last one, I'd like to make a plug for TEDx Boston that's happening June 28th.
Love it.
Look it up. Check it out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again so much for the chance to come here. I truly believe what I said about my excitement at what emerges from this room. And if you would, when it does start to emerge, please, you know, tell us about it. I want to see these dreams, these visions, these ideas, these designs. I want to see them. I think the world really needs them. Good luck. Thank you.